hearing on House Bill 5038, which is the funding bill relating to the Department of Human Services, Seniors, and People with Disability. Today we're accepting public testimony, and we have two overflow rooms, which may or may not be needed before this morning is over. If this room fills up, and for those that are in the overflow rooms, if you wanted to come up to the main committee room F, we still have probably 15 or 20 seats available. But there is overflow hearing room available in room 170 or in the orientation room, which is close to the kiosk. This morning, we will start with individuals that live more than 100 miles away that have come. And we don't have a huge list of people to speak. I have
we
about
have more.
There's more.
There may be more coming. Yeah.
Anyway, what I'm going to do is start off with 3 to 4 minutes each, and then if the list gets long, I may have to interrupt and shorten that down. I'm sorry for those that wanted to come and give more detailed remarks, but if it's going to take more than that, it really would help to give it to us in writing anyway, so that we would have time to really think about what it is that you'd like to say. And if anybody feels like they're being shortchanged, first, I apologize, and second, I would welcome you sending me in writing the information that you felt like you weren't able to convey. There's going to be people moving in and out of this of the committee dais here throughout the day. Please do not be offended or think that we don't care. There's just so much going on in this building. There are needs for members of the committee to go and testify. I myself will be leaving probably a quarter till 10 because there is a major bill that I'm carrying on the floor, and it's going to be a huge debate. And so I will be carrying aboard the bill that deals with the parental right to having notification before an abortion. And so that's going to be something that's going to have a lot of debate on the floor today. So please don't be offended if I hand the gavel to someone else and I leave. It's not because I didn't like what you were saying. It's just that other things go on. So with that, we're glad to have both Senator Montes Anderson and Representative Hanna with us. And we'd like to begin by, and by the way, before I begin, if there's any here who, because of their physical condition, feel like they couldn't wait for a normal turn, then I'm happy to take them out of order and give them a priority. So if there's anyone that is on the list and may not have indicated that, just, you know, let me know. And that you can either just wave, speak up, or give me a note. And seeing no indication of that at this point, I'd like to invite three individuals to come forward, and that way we don't have to waste too much time in transit, and then I'll also give some heads up on who will be on deck so that you'll know. We'll begin with Barbara Grant, who's here from Douglas County, and then Ellen Lowe and Lucille, I think it's Privitt, P-R-V-I-T-T, and then on deck will be Jim Carlson, Jim Davis, and Jacqueline Zimmer. Hey, Barbara.
Good morning.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to come in this morning and tell you about my personal experience.
You know, it's going to be important for everyone to identify themselves for the record because we have, first of all, this is going to be recorded, and then also there are people on the internet that are watching this from all over the world. Or at least for, you know, 10 or 12 people from around the building. So.
Our staff,
primarily.
My name is Barbara Grant, and I live in Roseburg. And I wanted to give you my personal experience. I'm a in-home care client through the state of Oregon, and I just wanted to say that one day I was working as a special aide on a school bus, and I was a substitute bus driver. And the next day I became disabled, needing my caregiver, Robert. And it's just something, you know, that you never really think about, you know, how quickly things can change. And I never thought any way in the world that I would myself ever need a special aid, but ends up that I do. And I know that unforeseen things happen all the time. That's why we need these precious people to be able to have the training and the wages and the benefits that they deserve so that they can do a better job for their clients. And there are about 13,000 caregivers of organ caregiving for the elderly people and people with disabilities at home, so that we don't have to go into nursing homes. We need to protect the state funding so that the home care program, so that the clients can keep their dignity and stay at home. I know this has meant a great deal to me, not to be able to be able to stay at home and not to worry about that. And it's not, I don't think that it's fair to deny services to someone like me that has no control over the circumstances that I face because of all the slots being full. And so please don't turn your back on us, because we really need your support.
Okay. Thank you. Did you have anything to say to us today?
Robert Grant, caregiver. Barbara pretty well summed it up. I am her caregiver. It does mean a lot. And we do need the support of you people to help us keep doing, as she had said, mainly the dignity at home. And we do quite a bit more than a lot of people know, but we got it pretty well wrote down here and explained. So sometimes I think we need to take a look at ourselves as we get to that younger age, because it could happen to us. And the cut of fundings is not going to be the best way. We thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you for taking the time to be here. It's a long drive from Douglas County. Ms. Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ellen Lowe, legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center and for the Oregon Food Bank, and it's on their behalf that I wish to express some reservations about the capacity of the governor's proposed budget to be able to serve folks like those sitting next to me and the others who are part of the senior and peoples with disabilities cluster. Both of the nonprofits I represent are very concerned about the availability, stability, affordability, funding, and quality of human service programs here in Oregon. So on their behalf, I ask that you develop a structure to measure the consequences of the choices before you, and that you include the human costs as well as the fiscal costs, not only to the state, but to all of its partners, including the families. And the projected savings can be very soft in the short run and non-existent in the long one. And I'd particularly like to emphasize today general assistance, where the information that you've been provided, I believe, is incomplete. Because apparently there was an assumption that there would not need to be any intake or eligibility responsibilities remaining for the SPD or the AAA offices when someone with the potential for SSI would seek service. Federal law requires states that participate in the Medicaid program to extend benefits to those who qualify for SSI. And so if an individual not currently receiving SSI but claims a disability, the state must determine whether or not that person meets the disability criteria. And if so, And the individual meets both the income and resource tests, the state must provide Medicaid, which in Oregon would be Oregon Health Plan Plus. The Medicaid determination information that they have for this process is the same that would be used for general assistance. There are also some untapped opportunities for increased interim assistance recoveries. For when there is a signed interim assistance agreement, the SSI retroactive benefits will be processed first, even if there's a concurrent SSI and SSD claim. Again, general assistance, the poorest of the poor. No more than $50 in cash, $1,500 in resources, disability for at least a year, and unemployment. So the elimination of the GA program, it's not going to eliminate the cost of disability criteria determination. It's not going to eliminate the match for the OHP plus. What it's going to eliminate is stipend of $314 a month while they're awaiting SSI, and which in cases where they are determined to be eligible will come back to us. It's a float. It's essentially a loan. I have included some other items in my written statement, and I just hope that you will do the same kind of analysis for each of those proposed reductions in the governor's budget that I just went through for the general assistance program. Thank you.
We'll look those over.
Thanks. Do we have time to ask questions today? Are we pretty booked up?
Actually, we have time if the
we don't take a long time.
It's okay.
Can I ask Ellen a quick question?
Certainly.
Ellen, one of the things I'm concerned about in the SSI determinations is that, you know, the state pays for those determinations to be done. Those are state employees that make the determinations. Do you know, from your point of view, how much time it's taking to get someone through the system now? The longer they're in this limbo of waiting for the termination to come through, the more we have to put them on assistance and then try to recover the money afterwards. Any time of the length of time the average person is going through, what's your sense of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I will give credit to the department that they have really given some assistance or impetus to the determination section, and so their process is speeding up every single day, I would say. On the federal level, it can sometimes take as long as 2 years, but it's usually about a year. But 2 years ago, when I sat before you, our own disability determination service was, I would say, somewhat in disarray. I don't see that now. And I think that under the current director, Taves, that you're seeing some progress being made. But that particular service is federally funded. And so it would be important to make sure that we make ourselves available for the assistance that we need.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, all. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Pruitt, Mr. Carlson, Mr. Davis.
Okay,
thank you. And on deck, I have Jacqueline Zimmer, Carla, Spence, and Jean. I think it's Yamamoto. And let's see, Arthur Towers. We can do all four.
I haven't been able to. I'll see here.
Morning, Dr. Davis.
Oh, no, what's happening? I used to sort of almost.
Good morning, Ms. Pruitt.
Good morning. I think my name on the list may be inaccurate, but at any rate, Chairman Richardson and members of the committee, I'm glad to be here.
And your name?
My name is Lucille Pugh.
I'm sorry, Pugh.
No, that's all right.
It's okay. We're here.
It gets mispronounced, misspelled, and what have you. I live in Salem, and I have been closely associated with Oregon's innovative long-term care services since its inception some 20 years or so ago, first as a staff member and more recently as an advocate. I hope that I can, in some small way, represent thousands of Oregonians who are dependent upon these long-term care programs but who are not able to be here today. A few of these seniors and people with disabilities are pictured in a booklet which was put together by the Northwest Senior and Disability Services Advisory Councils. Most of you have received a copy of this material as we have made our rounds about the Capitol. Copies of these are available to you who have not received the material. The information being distributed today, I understand, are stories about those persons who are receiving OPI, but they represent as well people who are receiving Medicaid services in their own homes and in community-based settings. The stories that we put together originally varied in persons who were as old as 103 and as young as 21 years. All of these individuals would probably be in a nursing facility at a considerably higher cost to the state were it not for community-based services which are available to them. Long-term care services has made a tremendous impact by assisting many seniors and people with disabilities to retain a sense of independence in a home-like environment rather than moving to a nursing home, which is technically a medical environment and a place who does for a person and at a considerably higher cost to the state. Nursing facilities have a role to play in the total range of care, but should not be used when community-based services can supplement a person's own abilities to maximize his or her independence. Community-based services are also a means of state saving both state and federal funds. An important byproduct of the community-based services which have been developed over the recent years is the use of these resources by persons who have ability to pay their own way. With the projected increase in population of both seniors and people with disabilities, it is important that we plan ahead for living situations and services which will accommodate that growth. I use as an example of this assisted living facilities, which have a large population of persons who are financially able to pay for these services. Had it not been for the innovative community-based care service programs, these facilities perhaps would not exist. I remember visiting the first assisted living facility in Portland. This was the beginning not only of this needed resource in Oregon, but nationwide. Oregon has done some innovative kinds of ways, things.
We're going to need to conclude. We have to wrap it up. We're already moving into 5 minutes.
All right. Thank you.
You could finish your paragraph, ma'am.
Finish your thought.
I'm just letting you know that I can't go into the stories any further.
The other thing that I would like to say is that there have been previous actions which have reduced service levels, reduced OPI, general assistance, and other programs which were designed to assist needy individuals. There also remains the question of equity in the SPD and the Area Agency on Aging who provide these services. I would just like to say one other thing. I hope that the programs will not be either terminated or severely cut back. I think there is probably a need for us to all sit down and plan for the future, but it will be much more difficult if the programs which now exist are cut back severely or terminated. I hope that we can come to terms with long-term care services and be supportive of them now and in the future.
Thank you very much. Mr. Carlson.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Healthcare Association, a not-for-profit trade association representing about 550 licensed long-term care organizations, running the gamut from skilled nursing, assisted living, residential care, independent housing, and in-home care agencies. Our members provide services to over 30,000 Oregonians each day. And I want to second the comments that Ellen Lowe made earlier about the need for stability of services and funding for this very vulnerable population. You have a lot of important issues in this budget. I'm going to only address three this morning, but I don't mean to omit the importance of some of these other issues. The first key issue I want to call to your attention is the proposed 33% reduction in assisted living rates. I know you've had a fair amount of discussion at the subcommittee level already, but I want to really try to make sure you're aware of what the impact would be, not just on the 4,000 Medicaid clients who rely on Medicaid services, but the additional 8,000 private pay clients who are receiving services in assisted living, because a cut of that magnitude would destabilize the entire care setting. If you take a facility that's, let's say, 50% Medicaid, reduce their revenues by 33%, for those remaining residents of that facility, you'd see dramatic cost increases in what those services would cost, and you would see diminished services in terms of the quality and continuity of care that would be provided. So what you're talking about here in this cut does not impact just your Medicaid clientele. It impacts also the entire population of individuals who receive services in assisted living. And I'm not going to go into any detail at this point about the impact on the Oregon Housing Community Services portfolio beyond to tell you you've got 45, 50 million at risk on those loans. The state's got skin in the game, so to speak, on this one because of the large role they played in financing.
Senator Carter.
Thank you. Jim, tell me now, when you talk about how that impact assisted living, are you saying that because the cost goes up so much for those who are the private payers and the people at the bottom of this cost shifting is taking place, if you will, that when you destabilize, do people find other options and move out, or what are you saying?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, what I'm saying is, first off, you're running the risk of seeing at least 50 to 70 facility closures out of 198 licensed facilities. So in those cases where you would see a failure, a facility actually forced to close its doors, every one of those residents would be forced to relocate and find another situation. So you're talking about folks in a stable care setting now. Second, what I'm saying is that if a facility is able to stay financially viable, the only way they're going to be able to remain viable is through cost shifting those Medicaid losses onto the paying private pay residents. And so, like, you and I were both out at Irvington Village Assisted Living in your district a month or two ago. They were projecting about a $400,000 a year impact from this cut because they're about 80% Medicaid. They would not be able to keep their doors open, as according to the administrator there and what we were told. So in that situation, all those folks would potentially need to be relocated to another setting. And then you get into questions on, is there existing capacity available out there in the system? You do not have that many empty adult foster care home beds anywhere remotely close to that in the state. You don't have that many empty residential care facility beds. You do have a lot of empty nursing facility beds. And I think you will see, you know, some impact there where folks would not go to a lower cost care setting, they would go to a higher cost care setting. And for your private pay population, if you're going to increase their rates increased dramatically, a number of those folks are going to then spend down, deplete their assets, and qualify for Medicaid on an accelerated rate. And so you could actually drive your Medicaid eligibility through that magnitude of cost shift. So I think this is, it's problematic on a number of levels, but I think this would be extremely difficult to implement and achieve cost savings at the same time.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the only comparison I was trying to make, because it does make sense that if a large portion of these people end up in a skilled nursing facility, then actually our cost to the state goes up greater anyway. So it's much better for us as a policy to try to keep people in assisted living situations rather than have to end up in skilled nursing care, because it actually costs us more money in the long run. And I want to hear him as a matter of record to say that, because I think that's something in terms of a policy that we'd have to think about.
Okay. Senator Bates.
Yeah.
Just to follow on the same reasoning, thanks for your explanation, Jim. Also make the point that we are required to pay for skilled nursing facilities. We're not required to pay for the side that we are required to pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to the situation in the hospitals where they are required to take on all comers in the emergency room. So if these people are transferred ultimately to extended care facilities or what we call skilled nursing homes, we're going to pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost is twice what we're paying now. This is a no-win game. We try to cut corners at the top end, it'll all drop down below.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, you are correct in that our substitute home program, which includes assisted living, foster care, and residential care, has been extremely effective at decreasing our nursing home utilization. And you got to strike a fine balance on that for folks who do need 24/7 care. The second two issues, very briefly, I wanted to call to your attention, is the DHS budget reshoot. On the caseloads, and I know the subcommittee is well aware of this, the governor's balanced budget dramatically under-projected and funded caseloads in this budget. And in the nursing facility program area specifically, I think you're going to see a significant budget issue when you see the actual caseload numbers. The caseload, the governor's budget assumes 4,564 cases. Actuals right now are probably somewhat over 5,000. The November e-board had 5,096 cases. And so you're going to see a significant issue there. Based on our estimates that we've done within our organization, we think you're looking at probably about an $11 million general fund item right there alone just on your nursing facility caseloads. Also, your community-based care facility caseloads and in-home care caseloads, I think you have issues with. So I wanted to flag that issue. And on the third issue, just very briefly, and then I'll let you just review my handout, on the home community-based care waiver cap, I think folks need to realize that the impact of this waiver cap is not that necessarily people are going to all move to nursing facilities. If we keep our in-home and our substitute home programs strong, I think you can deal with most services in those settings. But the problem I see with this is that when you have people who need to be discharged from the hospital or people who need to be discharged from skilled care, that's a significant issue on where are we going to discharge them to. And I just call to your attention some of the charts I have in my handout showing you lengths of stay in nursing facilities where the vast majority of people, 80%, have a length of stay of just a month or less. And so I think what you've got is an issue where if somebody comes in, their Medicare benefits pay for their skilled nursing stay, and they're ready to be discharged from that nursing home back out to a community-based setting, I think you've got an issue then where you have to make sure under any waiver cap criteria, if we had a waiver cap, that you can, that's a half description you care. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the
pay. That'll be quite enough.
Yeah. but if you, yeah, they like this. I think if you look at the nursing facility utilization data, a lot of people are surprised by it, and I've gone through this data with a number of members of the subcommittee, and so I think it is something that's worth looking at in terms of your consideration of that particular policy issue.
Okay.
With that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Bates and Senator Moss Anderson.
Mr. Chair, a statement and a question, too. On your nursing home page you see in the Medicare plans now, which are there for less than a month, they're really not a result of anything you're doing or system. What really is going on there is Medicare years ago made a decision that they would not pay for long-term care of those patients in the hospital setting.
Mm-hmm.
So fractured hips that used to be in the hospital for 2 weeks or a week and a half and go home, now go to a nursing home at a lower rate and go on out.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest that the program that we use for in-home care for people has been so successful that we could probably have closed some nursing homes if this hadn't changed. I mean, we've done that good a job in the programs you've set up and done it on a very effective basis. So even those people we look at as 33 days or less in nursing homes, that isn't the clientele we used to serve in nursing homes. Those are people who used to be served in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point I'd like to make here so we understand that. It's a savings for Medicare on mm-hmm. the health side.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do really with long-term care. And that's why that number looks so strange. Okay. The other thing I'm worried about, Jim, I'd like to hear if your organization has given us any numbers on this. We're going to be looking hopefully at a reshoot here fairly quickly. But what I'm concerned about is that we're going to have a Medicare pharmaceutical benefit going out to this population in the next 6 months to a year. It's going to include in that the very strange idea that you're going to be told if you have a Medicare prescription benefit by a card or whatever method, you might be eligible for other benefits also, which could bring more people into the system who mm-hmm. presently are not being served by it, which could really make a significant change in our budget. My question to you is, has your organization tried to do an estimate of what that might look like as far as caseload is concerned if, in fact, we have an influx of people applying for and being eligible for services who presently aren't receiving them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we've been spending a lot of time looking at all the Medicare Modernization Act issues, and you're going to hear, I understand, some testimony probably on the health services cluster, specifically on MMA, because it will be a very key issue for this population that's served in this budget, particularly those in home and community-based services. The Fed's carved out the nursing facility population so that you won't have co-pays or anything like that hitting folks in those settings. For home and community-based services, folks who are currently dually eligibles will probably be subject to co-pays, other limits on their pharmaceuticals, and they may not have access to institutional pharmacy services the way they do now. So that's one issue. On the issue you speak to, Senator Bates, it's going to cut one of two ways. You're either going to see it drive enrollment in Medicaid because they become aware there are these additional services, or the other way it could cut is that if people do get their prescription drug coverage, there's less of an incentive to become Medicaid eligible on the long-term care side just to get a Medicaid prescription drug card. The lack of having prescription drug coverage, I think, historically in Oregon after the advent of the health plan, did encourage some folks to enroll in Medicaid long-term care services primarily to get the drug card. And so, you know, the outreach piece is where you're going to see the potential for this to increase enrollment for our program when they become aware of other services. But I can't tell you at this point, Senator, which way this is going to cut. It's going to have an impact, and it's extremely difficult to predict at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's going to be a key question for us. I'm not sure it's one we're going to answer until after we've left session, unfortunately, because this is going to happen
mm-hmm.
the year. And, you know, we can do our predictions, we can do our reshoot. I'm a little concerned that the reality may not be in that reshoot. And not because anyone's not doing the best job they can. It's just an unknown, uncharted territory, something we haven't seen before. So it's something I'm a little concerned about. And I think possibly our reshoot numbers are being held up partially because of that, too. We've got some unknown things to put into that equation. It's going to be hard to figure out.
It's going to be difficult. Plus, we haven't dealt yet with the enrolling of this huge population of elderly into the Medicare Modernization Act. I mean, this transition where you have to go through and meet with them and find out what their prescriptions are and get that over to mm-hmm. the federal agencies and file so that they can obtain pharmaceutical care or drug payments as of January, February. Huge work.
Because I am hoping we're not in session during that time.
There's a good chance we'll be finished by the last quarter of this year. Senator Monson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I really want to thank you for this handout that you gave to us, because it was really enlightening to me that one in every 10 admissions to nursing facilities, first of all, comes straight from the hospital, not directly from home, and that about 80% at least only stay in the nursing facility for 3 months or less.
Mm-hmm.
And so that does show how good Oregon as a state is doing regarding its community-based housing. So or services. And what was really enlightening, too, is how much Medicaid is being spent. I was shocked that of the nursing facilities, by payer source, Medicaid pays over 60% of that money. And then Medicare, of course, goes about 10 or 11, no, actually more than that, yeah. 9, 10, 11, 12% But I really like your comparison of average per diem cost per case data for the Department of Human Services. And colleagues, remember, when you take a look at the most expensive, that's this one, the most expensive cost per day are Eastern Oregon Training Center and the state, the group homes. And look, and if you compare all the number of people that are all in the others, including the legislators, if you look at that one in the middle.
So I want to see you were paying attention there.
we're all moving to assisted living, Jim.
Yeah.
I mean, it really does put in perspective how little actually we are giving to maintain these people and what an extreme jump it is by taking them out of the community and putting them into nursing facilities. Anyway, this was very graphic and I think extremely important. Thank you.
Yeah. For those that haven't been able to see this, the indications on length of stay in nursing facilities show that 65% of residents in nursing facilities are there for less than 30 days, and that 82% are there less than 90 days. And so, I mean, before I was in this position, I'd assumed that people in rest homes were just there for years, and I didn't realize that nursing facilities had, I mean, I knew that they were convalescent care, but I didn't realize to what extent that had taken place. Anyway, thank you for the important information, and now we turn our attention to Mr. Davis.
Hello, I'm Jim Davis. Today I am representing Save Oregon Seniors, United Seniors of Oregon, Oregon Association for Retired Citizens, Advocacy Coalition for People, for Seniors and People with Disabilities, Oregon Association of RSVPs, and the Great Panthers. We're here to express our strong support for Oregon's senior disability service system and to oppose the cuts that have been recommended in the governor's budget. I've had the honor to be a gerontologist and advocate in this senior and disability service system since 1975, and I've seen the system grow as a national model for community-based care, providing an independent living environment for seniors and people with disabilities. And as Lucille so well communicated to you, community-based care is a very cost-effective investment for the seniors and people with disabilities, and I think Jim really outlined it very well in that handout. It saved the state millions and millions of dollars related to hospitalization and institutionalization. We are here to support the maintenance of continuing levels in senior and disability services. We have watched over the last 6 years in particular an ongoing pattern of cuts that have denied thousands of seniors and people with disabilities access to services, and we just simply don't want to see our model system unraveled, and we're feeling that it could, in future years, unravel if this continues. We see some of the most dangerous recommendations to date, and I particularly want to point to the CAP, or the CRAP, as Mr. Carlson referred to it. It is very apt, and because, you know, when you look at waivered senior and disability services, that's the heart of our system. You know, we were the first state to get a Medicaid waiver to enable us to have in-home and community-based care and have Medicaid pay for this. And to say that you're going to all of a sudden cap this and put people on waiting lists, it's something that we have never seen in our system before. And it's a process that would essentially have people waiting on waiting lists for people to die above them so that they can get involved in the system or to become so frail and so needy that they have to get involved in the system. We don't want to see that happen. We want to see all people who are eligible for the system to be able to get into the system and receive the services that they need. Another, very quickly, some of the other areas we're very concerned about. We strongly support Project Independence. We don't want to see that dismantled. That is the cornerstone of our system, and it is the safety net for those who fall through the cracks. And it should be open to people with disabilities as well. well as seniors. To echo Jim Carlson's...
Hold it, please. Senator Carr.
Yeah.
You just slipped one by me. Let's go back a little bit.
Yes. What did I slip by?
Brought it up in our meeting.
You said with the OPI we should add the disabled.
Yes, yes. We are supporting the modernization of OPI where people with disabilities, people with disabilities would be added to OPI. They aren't right now, and we feel they are equal partners in the system, and they should be part of those services.
Do you accept the notion that there should be some kind of asset testing or something that quantifies that?
Well, of course, right now, of course, Medicaid eligible is asset tested, but that's not a stand that that our groups have taken a stance on at this point. It's kind of a delicate point around eligibility, but I would have to say cautiously, yes, we probably would look at a reasonable one.
Jim, the only reason I'm concerned about it, because if you look at what Oregonians have said in terms of ballot measures, 28, 30, no new money in the system, I just don't see how we're going to get that. And you know what? I'm one of those people that could be right in that kind of a program right now. So I'm not trying to discourage anything. That my age put me there, okay? My concern, though, is that how do we get... how do we get some kind of federal dollar, matching dollar, or something in here so it's not just pure general fund? Because every year, all of us are concerned about this is one of the first areas that the legislature puts up for cuts. And I hate for any of us at a time in our lives when all of you younger ones have basically born your adult life on our lives because we've worked hard to be here. And yet it comes up to be cut every time. What I'm looking for, I don't just think raising the cap, giving more money. We need to find solutions to how do we keep people from every 2 years being so nervous about what the legislature is going to do to it. There's somewhere along the line there has to be some dignity at a point in time in people's lives when they have helped to build this country, this state, and there is some meaningful way that we still give dignity to them. And I think the thing that's going to happen, we have to not only have some borders here, but we've got to figure out some kind of way we have matching dollars. We've got to figure out some kind of way people are not feeling as if they're on welfare. I mean, because you know as much as I know, this is what the issue is all about. And so somewhere along the line, unless we can air our dirty laundry, only to come to the point of thinking how we put it all on the table and how we deal with it, deal with the issue of long-term care. These are senior issues that the state legislature should be trying to resolve along with all of you out here. But we can't just keep passing it by and scooting it in. So we have to put it on the table to deal with. And you, I'm depending on you guys' associations to be able to bring these issues here. I have to tell you, Representative Richardson has opened up a lot of worms that I think is really great because we haven't wanted to talk about a lot of these things, but we've got to be able to talk about them. And yes, and that's one of them, like you were saying, and long-term care is the next piece. And so unless those of you who are in charge of the associations and things of that nature don't bring the issues unclothed to us to work on, is not going to happen. So I think the disability piece added into the OPI piece is going to create a rub, and so let's just talk about it, and let's bring it up as an issue that we need to deal with. Because right now, I know if we look at the limited amount of dollars, 12,393, that we have in the system, I don't, Representative Richardson and other colleagues, I just don't see where that is going to happen.
Right.
And we need to start making some of these things happen and don't just vicariously bring them to the forefront. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does. Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, that does make a lot of sense. And I think there are serious financial considerations that we have to keep in mind. And so we maybe move into this process more slowly. But we do feel that people with disabilities are equal partners in our system, and they should be treated as such. And at some point, they need a safety net as well for those that do not qualify for Medicaid. And that's the beauty of OPI, even though it is generally general fund program is that it does catch those people who fall through the cracks. And that's why it is so effective in what it's done over all these years. We would certainly like to look at federal matching possibilities, numerous federal matching possibilities, but we don't want to take away the unique nature of that program as a safety net for those who don't qualify for Medicaid. If I might just cover just a few more points, and I am sorry for taking too much time here. I have been very involved with the development of the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program state projects as a gerontologist. I'm very proud of the work of these volunteers. And over the last 10 years, the legislature has given these programs $1.4 million, which is not very many. We have 15 projects around the state, volunteers that are going into the school systems, mentoring youth. They're doing crime prevention projects all over the state, and they're working on community service projects. They staff the with AARP, we co-sponsor and staff the consumer hotline at the Justice Department. And so right now there's 5,600 volunteers working in these state projects, or that have worked in the state projects. 120,000 people were reached, and over 400,000 hotline complaints were responded to, 730,000 hours worth of volunteer service. And if you put the national standard of $17.22 per hour, which is how volunteer hours are calculated, we have provided over $9 million to the state for your $1 million investment. So we would hope that you would also support the RSPP program. So in closing, I would just say that we do have a system that we've worked too hard to build, and we don't want to see it torn down by these type of cuts. We'd like you to make our system a priority, and particularly keep in mind that the baby boomers are coming down the pike pretty quick. And we need a good, solid community-based system to respond to this growing, both aging population and disability population. So I thank you for letting me be here today, and I just urge you to maintain senior and disability services.
Thank you. Jackie Zimmer, Carla Spence, Jean Yamamoto, I think, and Arthur Towers. On deck, Mike Volk, Colby, and Rhonda Stone. Ms. Zimmer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jacqueline Zimmer with the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. These colored sheets right here speak to some of the things I would talk about today if I had never-ending time, but since I don't, let me just lead off with a comment in response to Senator Carter's remarks about OPI. And Senator Carter, I'm sorry if you're not as apprised as we would like you to be about adding people with disabilities to OPI. We've been calling it OPI Modernization Act of 2005, and we've been speaking about it since the beginning of session. We haven't had a lot of public testimony in front of this committee, and so it's maybe why you're not as familiar with it. But we have had a hearing on it. It's Senate Bill 870. It is in Ways and Means right now. And since the Area Agencies on Aging, most of our offices do serve seniors and people with disabilities side by side. We're talking 18 to 64 physical disabilities. Some of our folks are here today. We have for a while wanted to add those people to the OPI opportunity. And especially after last session when so many people lost services, some of our Medicaid clients could in fact turn to OPI for some in-home care, but our people with physical disabilities that come up to the same counters that people who are seniors didn't have that same option. So it became even more important for us to add people with physical disabilities to that. And when you discuss the funding for that, we have discussed the idea of dedicating the surplus funds in the senior property tax deferral program to this particular program, and that would also help give OPI some stability in the future so it's not always funded and unfunded and funded and unfunded. Also, I'll just mention that we have looked on many occasions for federal match for Oregon Project Independence. Since it is a Medicaid diversion program, it doesn't qualify for federal match. However, we are very judicious with the funding in Oregon Project Independence, and we spend about $30 per month on admin and for that particular program. The rest of the money that a client, that's sort of allotted for a client, goes to direct services. So the idea of asset testing and so forth and estate recovery is worrisome to us, because each client gets about an average of $150 a month worth of care. So we don't really want to spend significant amounts of our time doing even more paperwork than we already have to do. We really want to spend that money directly on services. Also, clients in Oregon Project Independence, if they can, do pay toward their care. Some pay full fare if they happen to have significant assets. So it is a unique program in that the majority of the people that are using Oregon Project Independence do not really have much in the way of income. About 82% earn less than $1,200 a month. And those folks are probably paying maybe 22, maybe 29, maybe a dollar per hour for their care. But most of them are paying a little something for their care. So I'd be happy to meet with you and go over some of the concerns you might have about that particular issue. But hopefully we covered them in our handouts this morning.
Can I ask a question, Jacqueline? I noted in your material you talked about a wait list. How many, I'm OPI now.
Yes.
How many is on the wait list currently? And do you have that wait list broken out by counties?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that's a terrific question. After, even last session, when before the cuts were made in Oregon Project Independence, some areas of the state did have waiting lists for OPI clients, and in some areas we simply didn't even create a wait list because our caseloads were full. In some areas, they basically chose to only serve people who were, we have the 17 levels of care. We would only take people in OPI who matched the survival priority level of 1 through 12. And so it was left up to each area of the state, each area agency on aging, to make a decision about how best to use the OPI dollars that they had. And so therefore, I don't have what you're looking for in terms of a complete list, but we do have, we are serving less than half the people we were last biennium, and in previous bienniums we were serving up to 8,000 people on Oregon Project Independence. Now it's probably around 21 or 2,200 people. And so, again, now that OPI...
I mean to cut off.
Well, I need to. Otherwise, she's not going to be able to say anything else.
Okay. Thank you. Doug, one of the questions I have about OPI, and one of the biggest critics of the program, is lack of federal match money. But conversation with you and others, I'm beginning to think this may be maybe actually one of those blessings that doesn't have Medicaid match money. The reason is, and I'd like to have a comment from you on the record here, about the amount of administrative paperwork involved when you get a Medicaid match. I've heard figures up to 80% of the time being spent on administrative duties, and so the match is meaningless at that point as far as actually getting services to the client. So I want to hear what your comment on that is for the record at this point.
Senator Winters? Was there
I'll let her respond to Senator Bates, and then I'll follow back up.
Senator Bates, there is significant amount of paperwork required for a Medicaid client to pull down the federal match, but also those Medicaid clients that are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. Those that are using Oregon Project Independence are not eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, so that's unfortunate. If a case goes smoothly when you have a Medicaid client, I'm hearing figures of about 40% of the time could be spent doing checking for assets and so forth. If you get a client who's in the hospital whose daughter is trying to help them get eligible for Medicaid, maybe you end up rooting around in an attic looking for a file that has some sort of bond or stock or something in it. So it can be quite significant. And then as that changes, too, their income changes or their assets change, that also calls for you to go back. And so when you're checking in with a client, a lot of times you're checking in with their paperwork and not necessarily how they're doing. So it is a blessing in OPI that we don't have that requirement to do all of that paperwork. So I've heard 40 to 60% of people's time can be spent doing administrative work. A lot of that has to do with the mainframe and with the technology issues and with having to switch from screen to screen to screen to register the client for the various services that they're eligible for. So the state over the years has sort of not been able to keep pace with the funding pace with the technology that's out there.
Certainly, we've done that with the caseworkers for DHS when they testified that they spend less than 5 hours a week in face-to-face contact with those that they're serving.
My point, it makes OPI look a much better program if you're looking at that kind of administrative cost to Medicaid. I mean, what are you really getting? Where are you really getting help to people? OPI might be a better bargain for you than Medicaid. It might be a better buy.
Well, at less than $200 a month per service to help people stay in their homes, that is a very efficient program. Plus, if we get the more government gets involved, the more requirements we place on them, and pretty soon they're spending the majority of their time not doing the program, but doing meeting the requirements. So we need them to make sure that we don't overly encumber it. Did you have a final comment?
I just have a comment,
Senator Winter.
Because we've talked a lot about the need for federal match as a means for program. And it's fine if we can get federal match. That's wonderful. But I came from the position that we did things in Oregon based on good public policy. And irrespective of whether or not it is has the federal sanction or the federal dollars attached to it, and I don't think that it's good for us to be talking about whether or not we have a program that benefits the state of Oregon simply with the caveat that we're able to get federal dollars. Issue of OPI. OPI was brought into existence as a part of a system, if I can recall my history well, and a part that did reduce impacts on the rest of the budget, and simply because it didn't qualify for federal Medicaid wasn't a reason that we didn't do it. I would like to see us encourage nationally that they adopt what we've done in Oregon. We have a history of trying to set the mark high in Oregon and getting the feds to emulate what we've done in other states. I had to put that because there's a lot of discussion about the federal match piece, and certainly it's helpful if they can help us with the dollar, but strictly to use that as the gauge for whether or not we do a program, I don't think that that's valid.
In sum, with federal match, the strings attached.
The strings are still attached. It'll strangulate you.
And we'll
not end up with what you
and
end
we will
up
review
doing.
Your materials, and we'll move on to Carla Spence.
Oh, yes,
that's it. Carla Spence, please.
Ashley Jean Yamamoto.
Oh, okay. You're the one.
Thank you. Chair Richardson, members of the committee, my name is Jean Yamamoto, and I'm a union organizer with SEIU Local 503 OPEU, representing the Home Care Workers Union today. I also have a degree in gerontology at Portland State University and have served for over 3 years as a long-term care ombudsman and have over 20 years of experience as a reimbursement specialist in Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement issues. I am here to testify on agency with choice. Last week, James Tase from the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities testified to this committee on the proposed restructuring of the home care workers program to an agency with choice model. And SEIU is opposing this restructure because of the negative impacts it may have on the home care workers, represented workers at SPD, and on the potential impacts on our clients. In addition, the proposed restructuring has not been carefully planned out with full stakeholder input. The work group that was formed to review this plan has met only once. And in this one meeting, they only discussed their purpose, their role, and the proposed visit to the East Coast to review existing agency of choice models. And as Jim Davis testified today, Oregon is really the role model for its long-term care delivery systems. And when we visited the East Coast, they were literally on the edge of their seats to find out how we do things in Oregon, because clearly the funding for the Medicaid programs and the balancing act between capacity and the needs of our citizens are something that is shared across the nation. This is not a uniquely Oregon problem. So I joined this workforce. There are 5 members who went on this trip to look at agency with choice models. And in my written testimony, you can see that there are many problems in comparing the two two systems, agency of the choice of what we have here in Oregon. We do not feel it is comparable or compatible with what we have here. And there are more details in my written testimony. I won't go through all of that. The union is very concerned about the impact of moving the administration of the home care program to agency with choice model and the impact it will have on SPD case managers, client employee provider, clerks, because virtually all the care needs assessment, care planning, and authorization were outsourced. The only services left for case managers to do were the adult protective services work. And it's interesting that in some models, they broke out the assessment of hours and the care planning functions, and they split it out to subcontractors. So this caused a great deal of confusion on who's doing what, and the lack of communication, lack of coordination had a direct impact on client services. And in fact, the clients were frustrated that they had to go to multiple agencies to get their questions answered. So this will not be a cost-saving model. We know that the caseloads for the agency with choice were about 45 to 50 cases per case manager, which is about half of what our Oregon case managers carry.
Okay, I'm going to need you to continue.
Okay. We are very concerned about the impact on the home care workers because through the collective bargaining process, they were able to get increased wages, health insurance, workers' comp, and grievance and appeals procedures. And these were none of these were included in the agency of choice models. So in closing, we'd like to acknowledge that the co-chair's budget did not include any of the savings that were claimed in the governor's budget. We strongly recommend that any changes in the home care program be carefully and thoughtfully planned, and the minimal changes, if any, should be weighed against the disruptive effect it will have on the clients that we served. We believe that agency with choice is really the wrong choice for Oregon's seniors and people with disabilities and those who care for them. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Were you speaking for the three?
No. Sorry. My name is Carla Spence, Chair Richardson. For the record, I'm the director of the home care program, and I will keep my comments very, very short. Following up on what Jean said, when we first learned about agency with choice, we were told that the reason that this concept was even being explored was to rein in on the skyrocketing cost of workers' compensation. And through the course of the last year that home care workers have actually had the benefit of workers' compensation, the claims costs were high in the beginning, but they've leveled off and actually have started decreasing in the last quarter of this year. So we're concerned about maintaining and managing the cost of workers' comp, but we actually believe that there are ways to do it without jeopardizing the entire system. In the agency with choice models on the East Coast, they spent 4 hours on a one-on-one training per client. In Oregon, we have about 13,000 clients statewide, and I think that it is almost impossible for us to do that kind of intensive one-on-one training with a client. The Home Care Commission has a charge constitutionally to provide training opportunities to home care workers and clients, and they are beginning to do that work. They also have been working on establishing a registry, which I won't go into all the details, but if you would explore what a registry would do, not only in terms of streamlining the matching of clients with caregivers, it's also going to be a vehicle to provide return to work for injured workers and also an opportunity to more closely monitor and regulate unemployment claims because it'll be easier for home care workers to find work. But more importantly, the registry is going to be an opportunity to closely match home care workers who have specific skills and or disabilities or job limitations with clients who where they can best serve those particular clients. Representative Hannah asked a series of questions that were really quite Excellent questions, and I have included those in my testimony today. But I would just like to say that the Home Care Commission is a body that we ought to be looking to provide us with the guidance and also the ability to watch our claims, to monitor and to help reduce, to provide training for home care clients so that they're able to be more responsive in the home environment, and to partner with our AAAs and SPD agencies, with the case managers and others who work directly with the client, to help them live in a more safe environment and to leverage community resources for any kind of workplace modifications that they might need. Okay. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Towers.
Thank you, Mr. Richardson. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify today. And I will be brief so as not to reiterate stuff that you've already heard. But in short, we're extremely concerned about the impact an enrollment cap would have on the in-home care program. You've heard a lot of testimony the last few days about this topic. I thought the line of questioning the last couple of days was also insightful, that in fact what would happen is that those with critical needs would move to the front of the line, which is totally rational and reasonable, except that means that there'd be the slow-motion dismantlement of the in-home care program, because as the expensive critical needs clients are served, the amount of resources that are available dwindle. I think that Representative Hanna, Representative Hansen, in your questioning yesterday really hit the nail on the head on that topic. We also heard from Mr. Carlson earlier today about the unintended consequences that the cap would have on the skilled nursing facilities as well, and so I think that that impact should not go unnoticed. So given the level of uncertainty within the agency about the actual savings, about the nature and length of the waiting list, we really do feel it would be risky to proceed with an enrollment cap at this time. And the second point I want to reiterate is the point that Ms. Spence made earlier, that as we learn more about the experience with workers' compensation claims in the in-home care program, we see that those are starting to decrease dramatically. While the first 3 months did have a high rate of claims, the last 3 months, the most recent 3 months we have records for, January through March, the claims from caregivers injured on the job were 46% less than anticipated, bringing the annual total to 13% less than anticipated in terms of claims. So we have made good progress there. Right now, there's a proposal on the table to do away with workers' compensation insurance for home care workers. This would result in a loss of health insurance as well, since no group health plan will provide coverage to a group of workers that does not have insurance to pay for work-related injuries. So, in closing, we urge you to reject agency with choice, reject the enrollment cap, and adequately fund this program that meets so many needs in our communities. And finally, I want to
You said finally three times. We're all done.
I thought that would allow me to continue, but I guess not.
We are taking this to heart. Thank you, all three of you.
Thank you.
We now will hear from Mike Volpe and Colby and Ronista. Good morning.
Chair Richardson, the rest of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Volpe, and I am coming here to try to encourage you not to enforce the cap on home-based long-term care. This is the kind of care that I've been receiving for 12 years. And I think a previous speaker spoke to the slide movement. In other words, going from low-cost spending care options to higher costs. This would happen with the cap. As has been mentioned before, people would then be put on a waiting list, and then they would be forced to go to a higher-cost option. I've been receiving in-home care for about 12 years, and during that time, I've only had one in-home or in overnight hospital stay, which is obviously the highest cost of care. And so the care that I've received in my own home has enabled me to continue my... I have fairly decent health except for my MS. My MS has progressed, but my personal health is quite good. I would also like to let you know that receiving care in one's own home is a rather difficult process for the person that is receiving the care. It requires a lot of time. I need to I interview, I train, and I work with all the caregivers that work with me. And this is a very time-consuming task, but I do believe that this is much better. I cannot tell you the value this care has to me to receive the care in my own home as opposed to into a facility. I have received care in a facility, and I think that they are necessary options for the Oregon long-term care program. But I personally much prefer being able to receive the care in my own home where I can participate in society and I can be able to come here. As you can see, I don't have any movement below my neck. And I think I've spoken with a number of you before, but the people that work with me are basically the reason why I'm able to get here and able to look like I do. So I would like you to continue the lack of a cap on the in-home long-term care program, as this is the centerpiece for the long-term care program in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Rhonda and Kobe Stone.
Hi. I want to thank you for giving me the chance to come and testify today, and so does Kobe. Kobe understands everything. He's understanding everything that's being said right now. He moves his foot to answer yes, and that's how we communicate with him. He was head injured 16 years ago, and he has not walked or talked since then, but we have been taking care of him here at home through the relative adult foster care home. And I am here to plead with you to please fully fund the relative adult foster care program. It is a program that over the years has proven itself to be one of the most cost-effective programs there are. Besides letting people stay in their own home and not have to go into a nursing home, it is saving the state a large amount of money. I got some figures from Clackamas County today, and they said that the average cost of relative foster care home is $700 to $900 a month. The average cost of nursing home care is $3,213. In Clackamas County alone, since 1982, they have reduced the number of Medicare patients in nursing homes by more than half. In 1982, there were 802 in Clackamas County. There were 802 Medicaid nursing home patients, and in February of 2000, there's only 387 people in Clackamas County in Medicaid nursing home care. That is something that Oregonians need to be proud of. That is something that no other state can say they've done through the years, because every other state, I am sure, has increased in the amount of nursing home patients in their care through the years. But because of the innovative way that Oregon has decided to take care of their seniors and their disabled people, they are saving people's lives by letting them stay in their own home. I'm sure that this man right here would say that his life has not only been made a higher quality of life, and as my son and anybody else who is living in their own home. But by keeping them in their own home, you are extending their lives too and making them have a higher quality. And it's important to have sanctity of life. And with the number of people that are getting older in our community, the baby boomers, we're all going to need some kind of help sometime later on. And if you're not sure of the value of foster home care versus nursing home care, I recommend you go visit a nursing home and then go visit a foster home care and see where you think you would want one of your loved ones to live. I used to work in a nursing home before my son had his accident, and in 79 I saw the need for people to be able to stay in their own home because I saw what going to a nursing home did to people before they needed to go. And I started a program in 79 called the Home Helpers, and it helped people get help in their homes. I did not know that a few short years later I would be needing the help myself. But for 16 years we've taken care of Colby in our own home, and we're able to do it because we are supported to do it. But that is not the reason we take care of him, because we get paid. We take care of him because we love him, and we want him to have the highest quality of life possible, and we want that to happen for all the 2,000 other people that are in the relative adult foster care home. But being supported to do 24-hour care is a necessity to keep doing it. We have to hire help to help us. I can't work. We were a two-family income before his accident, and I can't work because he needs 24-hour, 7 days a week care. My husband and I have put our life on hold all these years to take care of our son. It's that important to us. And I know that other people that are taking care of their loved ones, it's important for them. And I urge you today to fully fund, not just partially fund, because I wouldn't want to see anybody go to a nursing home that's being taken care of in their home, but fully fund the relative adult foster care home, please. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Okay. Next panel. Susan Spondler. And Lee. And then on deck will be Lee Hazelwood and Christy Ford.
Senators, representatives, thank you for the opportunity to have me speak with you today. I'm here not because of personal reasons, but because I want to be a voice for those who can't.
Identify yourself.
My name is Susan Sponable.
Okay, thank you.
I'm a home care worker and a volunteer with SEIU, Local 503. And I'm not here because of personal reasons, but because I want to be a voice for those who cannot speak. People like my father. He has organic brain damage and has a hard time even forming a sentence. My father wasn't always this way. At one time, he was a strong, loving man with hopes and dreams. A brain tumor took much of what my father was away, but not his kindness and his loving spirit. He cannot do many things now that we take for granted, but he retains his dignity. I love him tremendously. I won't sugarcoat the situation. The brain injury to my father crippled our family for many years. We often had to make tough choices. One of those choices was to not put him in a nursing home. Our family believed this would have taken his dignity away and made him feel even worse than he already did, and possibly even killed his loving spirit. So our family dealt with the situation alone. Then we learned about the home care program. This program helped our family immensely. I was able to care for my father at home, and he was able to retain his dignity. My father is not the only family member I care for. I have a lively 7-year-old son with bright brown eyes. When I look into his eyes, I see a new dream for the future. He's so full of energy, in life, and I love him tremendously also. So, how can I choose between my father and my son, my past and my future? I cannot. It is unthinkable, and there is no choice. My question is this. Why do the most vulnerable among us always get hurt first? Why is there always a funding crisis that makes us have this debate session after session? Do we really believe that our children are going to be able to compete in a new world market without an education? Do we really believe that we will be able to be healthy and live forever? I'm here representing three generations of an Oregon family that needs a good educational system and a good health care support system for seniors and people with disabilities. I'm told that there's not enough money, but what I want the legislator to know is that I don't believe this. I believe that there is money. There are common sense choices that can be made, like raising the minimum tax paid by profitable corporations or restoring the 10-cent cigarette surcharge. I'm a normal tax-paying citizen. If I can come up with common sense solutions, surely our elected representatives can do the same thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Christy Ford, and I'm from McMinnville, Oregon. I'm here to put another face for those caring for family members in their home. I myself take care of my husband, who was injured in an automobile accident 4 years ago. At the time, we had a 5-year-old daughter, and I was also expecting with our second child. He was a cutter for a logging company, and I a stay-at-home mom. So once he returned home from the hospital, I was not only caring for two young children, I was caring for a quadriplegic at the same time. I was very relieved to find that eventually I would have somebody coming into my home to help, and I can't imagine having to have waited on a waiting list. I also can't imagine having him in a facility where my children aren't at home with him or where he's not at home with them, being active in their raising, being active in their lives. As I'm on the spousal pay program, I also have caregivers that come in at nighttime to help care for my husband. And when we didn't have any benefits, it was really hard to find out, to figure out, am I supposed to stay home and do this where it's more supportive for him without benefits and without my children being having benefits, or do I go out into the workforce and it costs more to have somebody else come in? As you know, as a spousal provider, I don't get paid for all the hours I do provide. Also, not having health benefits, it was kind of hard to find somebody that could care for my husband that was trustable, that you would want in your home with your young children, but that also could do a good job and provide what my husband needed. So once we won those benefits to have health care, just really changed the outlook of not only myself, but also hiring other caregivers in my home, and since then I've had steady caregiving. The services that is provided to home care workers keeps my husband independent and active, in not only in his community, but in his children's lives. And I think that's very important for you guys to consider. My daughter's in the back, and her life would be greatly changed if her dad was not in the home. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Let's see. We got Lee Hazelwood next, and just heard Christy.
Let's say this panel.
Well, Lee's getting situated. I'd just like to say for all the people that are testifying, we do a lot of work with numbers in Ways and Means, and it's pretty incredible that you can come forward and give us stories and show us what the reality is of the decisions that we're having to make. And we don't get to say it enough that we really appreciate your testimony, and you add a real important part to how we can make our decisions. Mr. Hazelwood.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood. I live in Staten, Oregon. I'm a longtime advocate for seniors and people with disabilities. I'm currently a member of Northwest Senior and Disabled Service representing Marion Polk Gamhill, class of Tillamook County. I'm also a former member of the Governor's Commission under the last three governors. I do not speak for my agency at this time, though. Over the years, I've represented Oregon at both the local and national level. I was a member of our state delegation to the 1995 White House Conference on Aging and appointed to a four-year term as a Silver Center to the National Silver Congress in Washington, D.C. In those capacities, I have come together with hundreds of senior advocates from all over the nation. Without exception, those advocates wanted to learn more about the Oregon model, or what is commonly known as the Oregon miracle of long-term care. Other states have come to Oregon to find out how we did it. In some cases, they have hired our people away to help their states implement similar programs. Now this highly respected, oft-copied system, which has constantly saved Oregon taxpayers millions of dollars in long-term care, is slated for severe cuts. In the governor's proposed budget, those proposed cuts would hurt real people who are in desperate need and deserve our help. These cuts are not just minor cuts and a reflection to a doctor, their regular major surgery, the type of surgery that can lead to a patient's death. All of you have heard from your constituents that our great system of long-term care is the best thing to come to Oregon since electricity. In fact, the system is actually a lawmaker's dream. What other program can give frail seniors and people with disabilities what they value the most? Independence, choice, and the delivery of necessary assistance in their own home or home-like settings. And foster the creation of hundreds of small businesses providing jobs around the state, while at the same time delivering those necessary services in the most cost-effective method. In 1973, then Governor Bob Schraub said, "It is in my opinion a disservice to place a man or woman in an institution when with a little help that person can remain in his or her home and community. For many, the lifelong dream of dignity, comfort, and independence in retirement has become a nightmare of dread. Instead, there's a cruel tarnish on their golden years. It's very hard for me to believe that the 73rd Oregon Legislature and the governor want their epitaph to read, 'We are the ones that helped dismantle the Oregon long-term care system.' Mr. Chair, I think it's time we put all the facts on the table. Many are saying that these programs for seniors and people with disabilities might not be sustainable. Well, let's talk about sustainability. I hate to admit this, for over 80 years, I and many others my age have been working hard to sustain our school program. We've been the ones that served on school boards, PTA, PTO, did door-to-door campaigning for school levies, bought all the candy, magazines, and any other item that our children and grandchildren sold to support their schools. Yes, we are also the seniors that helped craft and pay for school systems over the last six decades. We are also the people that fought in wars to protect the country in which we live, and yes, I would say that today's seniors understand the word sustainability better than anyone in this room. Yet what are the thanks we have give them for all their efforts? Now when they need our help, we reduce their budget by 43 and sometimes 48 million. You're right, these programs cannot be sustained with funding like this. During the last two legislative sessions, the K-12 school budgets have been funded at record amounts. Yet the programs that sustain the seniors are continually being cut. Now with the all-time high budget of $5 billion already guaranteed for schools, there's a move to tap into the projected $170 million of additional revenue. Let me suggest this. Let's make the programs for senior people with disabilities sustainable. Let's restore the funding for the programs and tell them thanks for helping sustain the great things of Oregon. Then let's get on with sustaining the other priorities. In our home, there are many books, some old and some new. One of these books, read many times over, was written over 2,000 years ago. In that book, it said, "Do not cast me away when I am old. Do not forsake me when my strength is gone. But as for me, I will always have hope. Even when I am old and gray, do not forsake me. Mr. Chair, you and your committee have some tough choices to make, and I know you are capable of doing that. But as I speak for many older Oregonians, I ask you, even though we are old and gray and bald-headed, do not forsake us. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hazelwood. We'll have, let's see, Jackie Blair, Father Mike Mascali, and Ruth Gallegos. And I apologize if I've messed up any of the pronunciations, but at least you know how to you know what I was saying. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Ruth Gallegos. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services. We are a not-for-profit membership organization representing not-for-profit providers of care, mission-directed providers of housing and services for the elderly throughout the state of Oregon. And we want to address two issues, the assisted living, and really paint the story about the local impact of which Father Mislowski and Jackie Blair are going to speak to you about. And wanted to mention the caseloads, but Mr. Carlson already gave you some good numbers on that. So I will, in the interest of time, turn it over to our providers in the community who are providing assisted living services.
Okay. Hi, my name is Jackie Blair, and I'm the director of Chestnut Lane Assisted Living Program in Gresham, Oregon. And it is a unique facility. It provides services, assisted living services, for people who are deaf and deafblind. It is, if these cuts go into play as they're written right now, I don't know if we'll be able to keep the doors open. And that will affect both Medicaid residents. People with developmental disabilities also live in our facility who would be living in group homes. It also would affect the, as someone mentioned earlier, the private pay individuals because they came here for this community. It's a very unique community. There are only five people there that are hearing, me being one of them. My nurse signs fluently. I employ over 37 deaf individuals who, again, it will... keeping our doors open will also help them because a lot of these guys, this is their first job they ever had. They have also gotten off of Social Security disability or Social Security income in order to be able to work in our facility. It's a communication-free barrier. Everything is set up and designed for deaf. It's a new facility. It's about 2 years old. Everything there is designed to help a deaf individual live the last part of their life's journey with dignity and with respect. Some people say, oh, it sounds like it's probably a very quiet place because no one talks. But actually, a deaf facility is quite a noisy place because they don't hear that they're banging the doors or they're, you know, banging into things. But, you know, it's a lively place because it is full of people coming there to be part of this community. Members of the deaf community from all over the state of Oregon come there to visit, to pay respect for their elders. A lot of the people who live there worked at the state school, and so they actually kind of almost like hold court sometimes when people from they come to visit their dorm moms. So it is it's become quite culturally ingrained in our community here in the state of Oregon. So I really implore you to please think about the impact that this would have on the deaf community. If they had to go into other facilities, they would be very isolated. They would not have those communication, which is the main part. They would not be able to communicate with the people that would be taking care of them. Even if they were in home care, it's very hard to find a home care providers that can sign. So please think about the impact of that. And if you're ever in Gresham, please come and visit us. We're right at the last stop on the MAX line. So if you ever ride the MAX, we're right there outside the door. Actually, it's a great place to be right beside the MAX line because they can't, because of their deafness, the noise of the MAX doesn't affect them. So I actually had to stay there for 4 nights during the ice storm this past January, and I wouldn't want to live right by the MAX tracks. But, you know, it's a great use of that property. Gresham has been wonderful to us. TriMet has been wonderful to us, and I hope that the state of Oregon continues to provide the funding we need to keep the doors open for this facility. Thank you for listening.
Mr. Chair, since Chestnut Lane is in my district and my sister was born deaf and is a part of the deaf community, she lives in New York right now, but whenever she comes, she always goes to Chestnut Lane to visit, as you say, her peers, mm-hmm. because there is a culture there and a bond there among the deaf community that's amazing. Anyway,
thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Michael Maslowski, and for almost a decade I have served as president of an independent nonprofit that has to date developed 5 housing and care facilities in the state of Oregon. It represents more than 400 units and an equal number of residents. It employs 100 individuals. It stands behind $40 million in state-issued bonds. And it provides care primarily to low-income individuals. I've been asked today to speak with some particularity about our situation and the consequences of the proposed budget cuts, and I'll do so by reference to our largest and our oldest facility, St. Anthony Village, located in southeast Portland. It is a facility that has 130-plus residents, 83% of whom are low-income seniors, 55% of whom have only Medicaid as a financing source. The consequences of the proposed budget cuts would be, first of all, the elimination of at least 40 positions for Medicaid recipients. 40 individuals who presently receive care of some level in our assisted living facility would be displaced. The consequences for us as a facility would be catastrophic. We would close our doors. By mission and by bond requirements, we cannot, even if they would be available, we could not replace 40 Medicaid recipients with private pay individuals. That would be a foreclosure of the $10 million bonds backed by the state. It would mean a displacement of 40 individuals, some of whom would be taken into homes already strained and unable to provide services, some of whom, as has been earlier testified, would go into far more expensive facilities, and some of whom, quite frankly, would be on the streets. It would mean a loss of jobs on the part of 65 individuals who are employed by that facility. It would mean foreclosing on debts owned to a variety of vendors, large and small. And most importantly, it would be a further rendering of our social fabric. Our sense of community that has been so often referred to here is integral to our identity and would be further evidence of the diminution of human dignity when it is most frail. Those are the statistics and the consequences, and they are fairly easy to articulate. I wish I could be more forceful and capable in helping you see the realities and faces behind those statistics. I wish I could make you see the what it's like to make the decision that we made just 3 days ago when 2 rooms became available in our Alzheimer's cottages, for which we had 8 existing residents and more than 24 Medicaid applicants, all of whom had to be turned away. I wish I could make you see the faces of families who have neither the emotional nor financial resources to deal with mom or dad at this stage of their life and must deal both with guilt and fear and the humbling gratitude that comes from recognizing that someone else can. I wish I could make you understand and see that when we try to solve social problems by placing at risk the most vulnerable, the most valuable, the oldest, we invite social chaos. It is social triage that lies ahead of us. The determination of who or who is not valuable. And if history is any record, it will be the most frail who are deemed not to be. I will also, and it's a professional hazard, risk playing the prophet. And the prophet is this. Age and illness and infirmity seem to surprise each of us. None of us thinks it will befall us. But what is natural to individuals should not be common to government. It is your responsibility to anticipate when we will not. It is your responsibility to respond when we cannot. Do not fail this state. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next three speakers, and the final three speakers, will be Ruth Shepherd, Sarah Westerford, and Suzanne Pecor, and with a client, Ethel Grant.
Well, Ms. Picard, if you'd want to, we'll wait and have you come up separately and have the other two come first so there will be a little more room for everyone.
So, Mr. Chair, while they're coming, I just want to welcome our friends from Irvington Village who are here today. We were just there last month, and so it's good to see you guys back there.
Ruth Shepherd would be.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ruth Shepherd. I live in Salem. And I have that pesky habit, I guess, that we all share of getting older. And I hope, however, and I make a big effort at this, that we don't always play the classic role of being old. I think the most important thing we can do in Oregon at this point is look ahead in terms of what's happening to the older population and their meeting their needs. So I can say that in 1966, I can remember coming up here from Eugene as a paid consultant and helped start the first structure of services for aging. And I do go back a long way with a lot of experiences in between. I want to put a real bright light on the one set of things that you need to remember, I think, about all of long-term care. And that set has to do with home care. And when I use that term in the next 3.5 minutes, I am thinking about Medicaid-funded as well as OPI-funded. The most appropriate and least expensive, but the most desired setting for long-term care is home. It's simple. You know it. And almost all long-term care needs can be met at home. It prevents the unnecessary utilization of the more costly care settings. It does by data that we can show, that we had no idea we could show 30 years ago. And it prevents unnecessary utilization in all the range of services as well as nursing facilities. Nursing home expenses appear to be somewhat on the rise at this point in your data books. Home care has shown to be flat. That in itself is a dangerous situation and the center of my comments to you, because the relationship of home care and the other services in the range of services on the continuum is a very, very important perception to use in your decisions, tough decisions, as I must admit, that you have ahead. So if that all be true, why is it, when we all know we're facing a crisis in long-term care, that it's recommended nonetheless that funds for home care be capped in Medicaid and cut in OPI? Thanks to each of you, I must say, for your continued participation in very important but thankless jobs. in response to the options which we have presented in the which are presented in the governor's budget, I'd like to focus that strong searchlight on the importance of housekeeping, which we used to call cookers and copers, or substitute sisters. And I still prefer that definition of the housekeeping role. But the other very important role, too, is the personal care that we're talking, the element that we're talking about within the home care settings. It's the most important part of any of the other choices within the range. These are the facts to make the case for more, not less, home care as you make your important decisions. People who need long-term care come from all income and asset levels. Most long-term care can be met in home settings. Home is the location favored overwhelmingly by the senior population and their families. And the next point, of course, is that care to the aging in all of this range of service is an intergenerational issue. It involves inevitably families or friends or neighbors. It speaks to the need for the younger generations to think that they also have this pesky habit of every day growing older. And it lays aside, for budget considerations, a separate category that isolates us from the rest of the fabric you're talking about. In-home care still is, and almost always is, the least expensive kind of long-term care. And I say that knowledgeably about saying that still is, because the realities of it is, of our situation in Oregon today, is that it still is the least expensive. Family members provide housekeeping and personal care for almost 5/6 of all the people who receive that kind of service in home, which has an implication for you if we think about it. If you're talking about 6/6, what percentage of that whole is before us to deal with? It's known to be, we can project this 1/6 much more easily than we can in other care settings about how many of the total population are we serving or not.
Ms. Shepherd, I think we're going to have to wind up because I'm
all done.
Great, because I'm trying to get a couple more in before we close at 10:30.
Thank you.
And I always hate to cut you off because you're one of the real experts in this area, but we did it anyway.
No, Mr. Chair, you have a room full of experts.
Thank you.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Westerfeld, and I'm a student at Portland State University. I'm getting my master's in social work. I'm also a member of the National Association of Social Workers, where I sit as the vice chair of the legislative committee. And I've worked and volunteered on behalf of people living with disabilities, seniors, people experiencing homelessness, and also college students. So I'm testifying today on behalf of over 1,700 members of Oregon Chapter of NASW, National Association of Social Workers. And I want to express our support for your efforts in restoring the funding to our valuable programs here in Oregon, but there's more work to be done. Specifically, I would like to talk about Oregon Project Independence, as many people already have done today. So I just want to hit on a key point, that the average OPI monthly cost per client is $130, yet the average in-home cost for Medicaid long-term care is $900 a month, where the state general fund share that is about $360 a month. So it's just real cost sense to fund it, to restore funding fully. I also urge you to look at revenue recovery options to assure funding for quality services and schools for all Oregonians. There's no need to pit schools, seniors, and other human service organizations against each other. So some options are raising the corporate minimum tax, repealing tax breaks for things such as pleasure boats. That would generate $27.6 million in revenues, approximately $10 million of which would go to general fund dollars. Also restoring the 10-cent cigarette tax surcharge. Sure. So thank you for your commitment and effort to make Oregon better for everyone.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Carter.
Thank you for your presentation. I really wanted to tell the young lady who came up about her father and others, we would love to raise taxes because we're going to have new money in the system. But it takes 90 members to have that done. And for those of us, especially that serves on human services, that would not be a problem. But we have not been able to get a tax through this, through sending it out to the voters, nor through the legislature. And we just want to know, for those of you who have offered those ideas, it's not falling on deaf ears. It's just that we cannot get 90 people to support. We cannot get a core group of people to pass a tax measure through this body.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to follow a comment, too. Not only can we not do that, but when we did do it, the people of Oregon overturned it in ballot measure 30. And the result is this, what we're looking at right now, a disaster in human services, underfunding of our education system. But I do appreciate you bringing up the idea, again, that the problem here is that Oregon has fallen from 25th in nations in taxes to 45th or 46th. You can't fall that far without paying a terrible price. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, okay. Senator Carter, Senator Bates.
Thank you. Our last two guests will be Susan Kapoor, Ethel Grant, and Dolores Hubert.
You might just put something out.
The Senate's still here.
Yeah.
And one member of the House.
Well,
carrying.
The reason we're losing members, the Senate is going to convene in about 5 minutes, and the House convened at 10 o'clock and debate on one of the bills that started, which required Representative Hannah to leave. But go ahead.
I'll be real quick. My name is Suzanne Picor, and this is my home health client, Ethel Grant. Ethel's 89, and she lives at home, and I've been caregiving her for about a year and a half. Before that, I came into caregiving. Before this, I was a civil engineering technician, and I worked on heavy highways, so I really didn't see myself in this role. But I guess I needed something that was more human than what I was doing, because this is what happened. My mother has Alzheimer's. She lives in Lake Oswego. And I came home to visit her for 10 days, and I stayed a year and a half. Because as the other person was talking earlier, that it's very hard for families to come to terms with their matriarch sort of getting old. So that's what happened. And after that, I got my sister to come and do what she said she wanted to do. And then since then, I started to apply for work, and I guess the worst 2 months of unemployment in Oregon State in a long time. And what came up for me was that Ethel's son was looking for someone. He didn't really have anyone to help take care of her, and he very much wanted to have her in her home. So I started doing that about a year and a half ago, and I got introduced to the union. I just didn't know anybody, so I just went to a union meeting and was able to get health care, which was very important to me at the time. Still is, of course. And then I was able to volunteer to become a CPR instructor. And so since then, I've been instructing across the state for home health care workers in first aid and CPR. And so I'm just learning how to talk in front of a group of people. And I know that there were an effort made to collect taxes, but it was also at the time that I was unable to find work that those ideas came up and were voted on. And Oregon is in a little better place now than it was a year ago or even 2 years ago. And so it may not be met with such a negative response now that the economy is a little bit more on its feet, I'm hoping. So the home health care workers need to have some source, some resources to keep themselves educated on simple things like CPR and first aid. CPR is a requirement to become a CNA, which is the lowest basic level of being able to have the information that you need to do home health caregiving. So I just, I think it's real important. And right now I'm doing it as a volunteer, and that's fine with me. And I just, but we just need to be able to have the funding just to pay for my car to go to the different parts of the state to teach it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hanna, members of the committee, my name is Dolores Hubert. Thank you for allowing me to testify quickly. I am a retired nurse from Multnomah County, and I'm also the chair of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I have about 6 pages of testimony that I'm not going to go through. The future will judge us all on how we handle this current crisis. Will we be seen as leaders who can weather this cycle, or will we be known as those who destroyed a model system? That is a real salient question for this committee and for this legislature. We urge you to make the right decisions and find the funding necessary to restore services and to hold the line on any additional cuts to the system. I hope that you will be able to read my testimony. It's very explicit. We urge you again to hold the line on any additional cuts, and thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you all for testifying and for helping us.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Carter.
I just want all the people that are here for OPI to know that in our budget, both the House and the Senate, we've totally restored the $11.1 million to Project Independence.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a reminder that tomorrow we'll continue with public testimony on the senior and people with disabilities cluster. I think the emphasis will be more on services for developmentally disabled persons, but that is coming tomorrow. So,
okay. Thank you. Thank you all, and we're adjourned.